Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
My name is Hannah Forden. I'm the membership coordinator at Heritage Radio Network, but even before I joined the team, I loved listening to HRN during my subway commute. It made the time go quickly and left me feeling inspired for the day ahead. HRN listeners tune in from all over the world. But there are a few traits that we all have in common, no matter where we listen from. A curious palate, the fierceness to make a difference, and a hunger for lifelong learning about the culinary world. As you know, Heritage Radio Network is a listener-supported nonprofit. To deliver the most ambitious, entertaining, and of-the-moment stories in 2018, we need your help. We need to raise $150,000 by December 31st to accomplish these goals and to keep your favorite shows on the air. Together, we can make this HRN's most exciting, impactful, and delicious year yet. Become a member by donating today. Join us at heritageradionetwork.org/donate, and you'll immediately start enjoying benefits such as VIP invitations to HRN events, where you will mix and mingle with your favorite hosts. Memberships also make a perfect holiday gift for all the foodies in your life. This year, why not give the gift of food radio? You'll hear your generosity in action for the year to come. Help keep our lights on and our mics hot by pledging your support today at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Thanks for listening.
Hi, and welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Carmen DeVito. Alice is homesick with a little boy today, so it's just me today. We are collectively the ladies of Groundworks, Inc. We design and build gardens in New York City and the surrounding area, and our show brings the culture to horticulture. In fact, this week we planted some trees in the snow. That was a first. Interesting. Beautiful, fun, but glad we don't have to do it again for a while. Hopefully never. So get ready for one whole hour devoted to a discussion of all things budding. As many of our regular listeners know, we had a theme running through all of our shows this year, land and climate. Our country's big. We have a lot of diversity in land, people, weather, and climate. And Alice and I wanted to highlight that by using the USDA map as a guide. So we have devoted one show to each of the USDA zones and the people. Yes, Dave, thank you. Let's end this season right. to the people and places that make it unique, even Alabama. And now we have come to the end of the series and the end of 2017 season with a look at Zone 1. But this show, we're also going to do something special for the last show of the season and end with a look back at where the season began at Zone 13. So, on the second half of the show, we will revisit Zone 13, located in Puerto Rico, and see how the island and its landscapes are faring after the devastating hurricanes Irma and Maria that hit them this past September. As some of you know, it's a place that's very close to my heart, as my dear friend and mentor Scott Appel lives there, and I've had the great fortune of traveling to the island and exploring the natural forest and landscapes there. But first, let's get into Zone 1. We save the coldest for last. It is the absolute coldest zone, with average minimum temperatures of negative 60 to negative 50 Fahrenheit. And that zone can only be found in Alaska, nowhere else in the continental United States. And it covers a lot of northern and central Alaska. This part of the country has more in common with Siberia than with the rest of the United States. The North Slope and the Yukon are all in this zone, as well as America's most northernmost town, Barrow, Alaska, now renamed Utqiagvik, which I hope I'm pronouncing right, which I'm probably not. So this town, located 3,500 miles from Washington, D.C., is closer to Tokyo and St. Petersburg than our nation's capital. But what's weird about it is, considering its remoteness, it's a pretty big town. It has 5,000 inhabitants, most of which are Alaska natives. Interestingly, it's also one of the oldest continuously inhabited places in North America. There's evidence that humans have lived here for almost 1,500 years, hunting whales and other animals for meat. This town sits close to Prudhoe Bay and one of the largest oil deposits in North America. So now it depends on the oil industry for its living. And what I found also fascinating was, for a place with no paved roads and no roads connecting it to the rest of Alaska, the median income there is $80,000 a year. Like, you could almost live in New York on that salary. Compared to the U.S. national average, which is $55,000 a year, I'm kind of tempted to think what my life might be like up there in the tundra. So I know we've had a few shows where in the past couple of zones, we've focused on Alaska. It's just huge, and it covers so many different zones, and there's so many interesting ecosystems. And in a minute or so, we're going to bring on a couple of guests from Alaska, from the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. But I just wanted to touch briefly for a minute or so and talk about the ecoregions, because it is so diverse. Alaska has Zone 1, of course, as we've talked about, and Zone 2 and Zone 3, but it also goes all the way down to Zone 6 and 7, which is New York. And it includes so many different types of environments. There's the Arctic tundra, there's the subarctic tundra, there's the Beringia boreal, there's mountainous boreal, there's hypermarine environments. It's just really, really interesting. And a lot of the information that I found that I'm sharing with you is on the Alaska.gov website. They have incredible information about Alaska and about its environments. And what I found really fascinating too, and surprising, were some of the plants that I was familiar with that live in Alaska, that make it through the winters there. And I wanted to share some of them with you, which I was kind of surprised. For example, there are rhododendrons that can live up there. There are willows that also live up there. There's poppies and different kinds of grasses. There are alpine azaleas and blueberries and cranberries. So that was like really cool to read about those kinds of plants that we grow here and that can also be grown up there in Alaska as well. Gardeningknowhow.com has a kind of bigger list of that as well. So I think we're going to bring on our guest, Dave, in a minute or so. What else did I find that was in? Oh, Pasque flower, Labrador tea,
tufted saxifrage. All those were really kind of cool plants that I didn't expect to find there in Alaska. And I guess they have to be pretty rugged. And that's one of the things we're going to talk about with our guests is how the plants have adapted to the environment and what kind of special adaptations they have made to their physiology, to their biology, in order to be able to live there in that very cold environment. I mean, think about it. Right now, today in New York City, it's about 50 degrees. And the coldest it can get on average, that means it could get colder, is negative 60 in Alaska. So that's like a 100-degree difference. I don't think I could deal with that. I don't know about you guys at all. We have two great guests on the show today, two agronomists from the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. We have Pete Johnson and Rusty Forker. Hi, guys. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Carmen. Thanks for having me on. Hello, Carmen.
Hi. Thanks so much for chatting with us today. So I want to jump right in and start talking about the weather. What's it like up there right now?
Well, Carmen, I say actually we're hitting a little bit of a warm streak here. We haven't quite gotten all our normal cold winter weather.
And, no?
The past couple weeks has kind of been blustery and warm. But as I look at the weather, I think that's sure to change, and we'll be back to our normalcy here coming up pretty soon.
Well, it's 50 degrees in New York City today. How cold is it up there where you are?
It's about 42 degrees right now.
Wow. I'm thinking it would be like a lot colder than that.
We're actually
Most of Alaska was thinking it was going to be colder than that, especially all those ski bums up here are thinking that it was going to be a little colder than that, too.
Oh, they're disappointed.
Yeah, but good things come to those who wait.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're going to get an Arctic blast tomorrow. I think it's going to actually get a lot colder, so we're going to enjoy this weather while we can. Anyway, let's talk a little bit about the ecosystems. On the Fish and Game's website, I found so much really interesting information. I learned that there is an enormous diversity in Alaska. There are 32 ecoregions from temperate to polar. One of you guys can jump in and tell us a little bit about some of the regions that are most unique to Alaska.
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to jump in on that. I guess one of the biggest reasons why we have so many of those different ecoregions is just based off of the fact that Alaska itself is so large. When you compare that to the fact that it has mountain ranges that extend from interior out to the coast, with vertical relief coming basically right off of the shore. So when you have mountain ranges breaking up areas from coastal to interior, you're creating multiple different biomes just within that area.
Okay.
Just for example, a couple of those is where we're at up in Palmer. We're just north of the most northern temperate rainforest in the world, actually, and the longest and largest, which includes the Tongass National Forest and the Chugach National Forest. So when you see that, we can have areas of precipitation to where just south of Anchorage and near Portage, where you go up into the ice fields there, you can have areas that have 100 feet of snow and 100 inches of rain.
Wow.
And you go a few hours north of that into Denali, and you can have areas that have 10 inches of precipitation total a year. So just seeing that just within a couple of hours is what makes it such an amazing place to be and amazing place for plant lovers alike, especially.
Yeah, that's what was really interesting to me. As I said in the intro, we've been doing the show going from zone 13 to zone 1. So we're here in zone 1 now. And I wanted to ask you guys, what ecosystems fall into that USDA zone 1? Do you all know?
I'll go one more here, so I'll make sure I don't want to try and get all the good stuff here, Rusty. But I'd say when you start getting towards zone 1, that's where you're kind of hitting towards the North Slope, Northwest Arctic Borough, when you get north of the Brooks Range.
Okay.
That's when you start taking that tundra area especially. You have areas of tundra before that, but that's where it becomes primarily tundra. And that's where you're looking at in that zone one area. And when it comes to tundra itself, you're seeing obviously a lot less trees, meaning nearly zero, unless you would include shrubs, but primarily just shrubs, grasses, and a few forbs. That's what you're seeing in that zone one area.
I was going to ask you about that, and you kind of answered. So, you know, tundra is the kind of word that you learn in, like, high school science class, right? And then you forget what it means. So for our listeners, including myself, who forgot what tundra means, how do you define it from an ecological or botanical perspective? Rusty, do you want to jump on this one?
Sure. Well, the tundra comes from a Finnish word, tunturi, and it means treeless heights.
Okay.
And it's basically where winters are long and cold, summers are short, and they're not even that warm in the summer.
Right.
But in the lowland areas, you'll even find it, you know, it's kind of a desert system, but there's a lot of areas where there's standing water, and most of that is due to the permafrost, where the water has nowhere to drain. So most of the plants have adapted to it, and they have very short growing seasons. They don't grow very fast, and they save up a lot of their nutrients throughout the winters. And that way they can start growing as soon as the seasons break.
As soon as it warms up to above freezing, or they start, or is it a function of sunlight as well? They respond to the higher sunlight?
It is both.
Okay. Yeah, I found that really interesting about the dryness. I mean, I had read that there are parts of Alaska that get less rain than the Mojave Desert. So that's really fascinating to me, you know. And you have some what I would consider kind of xeric plants. I read that American beach grass, blue stem, can live in the tundra. Is that true?
Yeah, especially in coastal areas, especially when you're talking about that beach grass, that's actually a grass here that we have cultivated varieties of, especially the Plant Materials Center, that we use for areas for either revegetation or for sort of shoring up some of these areas that might be losing some shoreside.
Mm.
But they're able to survive in this just through the adaptations that you'd kind of been mentioning. Being able to survive in these well-drained soils and just making every use of possible moisture that's present. It's interesting, too, is that when you have these different plants that are able to make use of any precipitation that's around there, is that when you see these areas that are in tundra, sometimes that can be replicated by moving towards alpine regions.
Oh.
So you'll see a lot of times some of these tundra plants will also be in alpine areas, so they're able to spread to different parts of the state, but maintaining those same characteristics that you would see on the tundra.
Well, we touched.
That's kind of what makes it such a diverse community in that effect.
Yeah, I mean, when I look at photos, I was looking at a lot of photos of Alaska tundra, and it's really beautiful, and the colors are so interesting. You know, it's not just like a swath of different shades of green, but there's like rusty colors and browns and reds. And so these plants, you touched a little bit about the adaptations. Tell us a little bit more about what plants have done to survive in those conditions. What do they need to do?
Sure. Rusty, why don't you start off there, and I'll fill in if there's anything that you leave left.
All right. So, Carmen, I heard you talk about Labrador tea earlier.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting things with it is that it's considered a dioecious plant, but it will actually hold on to, I'm sorry, not dioecious, deciduous, and it will actually hold on to its leaves through the winter and store its nutrients there.
Hmm.
And that also helps protect it from the desiccating winds that the tundra experiences quite a bit. There's some other plants, too, that are, most of them are perennials, of course, but the woolly loosewort will actually protect itself because the stems are furry, this
mm-hmm.
full of hair, very pubescent.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps retain dew from the changing temperatures from night to day. collect that moisture and also help protect it from the desiccating winds.
Yeah, we have to, if you have a relatively treeless landscape, wind is a big factor. And it's funny because we make gardens on roofs in New York City, and wind is one of the biggest things that we have to consider when we choose plant material, the kinds of trees, the kinds of shrubs. It is kind of a beachy, windy environment, kind of without the salt. We have pollution instead that the trees and plants have to contend with. And I guess you guys don't really have to deal with that so much up there, right? You're still pretty pristine.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing just in this wonderful place. And so much so that there's areas where within Alaska that's kind of been referred to as a living laboratory, just because of its pristine nature. They were able to see these plants growing in such natural habitats without having those additional influences. Kind of had, as Rusty had mentioned, with some of these plants, such as Labrador tea or that rhododendron, I think you'd kind of mentioned before that there's a rhododendron growing in Alaska, and that's
yeah.
It's the Rhododendron tomentosa is the Labrador tea. And by maintaining some of its lower growth habits, it's kind of a twofold effect. Is that one, as you'd mentioned, it is able to stay out of the wind by growing low and growing slow. And it's also able to basically put more energy into producing either a fruit or seed and reproducing as fast as possible. The areas up in that zone one generally only have a 60-day growing period.
Wow.
So when you figure that they have to try to reproduce within that 60 days, there's not a whole lot of time to gain a whole lot of elevation when you're growing. So it's a lot of times, like I said, keeping low and low to the ground is a twofold parameter in this.
So stay low to the ground, grow furry stems if you can, reproduce quickly. Anything else that is kind of required? It sounds like what I would need to do if I went up there, actually.
Yeah. You know, it's also, and a lot of this stuff, too, is as we're all plant lovers alike, is that mm-hmm. you can't help but sort of notice all these different nuances, and it might not necessarily be based off anything except your own preferences. Is
sure.
that I feel, and I guess I could say I might be biased that I moved up here to this area that's so beautiful, is that by having that short window that you really have to like heighten your chances for pollinators.
Yeah.
So by being so vibrant and beautiful, but yet remaining small, you have to really entice those pollinators as much as possible. So like I said, that might be my own personal bias, but I really feel like these plants are just really exploding with color.
Yeah.
When you see things, when you see the different heathers and things that are growing on these hillsides and things like twin flowers that are so vibrant. Even and especially growing up towards when you start moving towards kind of some of these higher elevations, and you see the forget-me-nots.
Yeah.
The Alaska state flower with the blue and gold represented in the state flag, just because that's what was so beautiful and vibrant, is that you can see that all these different adaptations these plants have not only done to survive, but to thrive.
Wow, and so
in
they're
a harsh climate.
Yeah, and there's still stands of it, of that native flower, in parts.
Absolutely,
that's great.
When you start kind of moving, I feel like when you're moving more towards alpine areas, you start seeing it become more and more prevalent. Also, just because when you do start moving out of the tree line, and really in a lot of areas, that's only a couple thousand feet above sea level, if that, and. That you can start to see some of these other smaller alpine flowers, which kind of reflect areas in the tundra, just really become vibrant and beautiful. And they have 60 days to do all that, and that kind of adds something, some magic to it also.
I think it does. It's kind of, I mean, I guess it's not an exact comparison, but it's kind of like an annual here in the temperate zone. Like they really just have to do everything they need to do in that short window, you know, set flower, fruit, seed, everything, and then be done, you know, even though they're not
annuals.
I want to talk about, we can't talk about tundra without discussing moss, I think. And one of the plants that I found really interesting in reading about this region was Arctic moss, Calogeron giganteum. Can one of you guys describe it and tell us a little bit about where it grows? Because it's an interesting plant.
Well, Carmen, as I was saying earlier, in the tundra, mm-hmm. you have a lot of areas where there's standing water due to the permafrost, so you get these lake beds. And the Arctic moss is actually an aquatic plant.
Yeah.
And it will grow on the bottom of these, you know, fens and lake beds. And it is, what's amazing about it is that it's, you know, it's all permafrost in the tundra. So you're getting these plants that are growing in the water, collecting as much sunlight as they can, but they only grow maybe a centimeter per year.
Wow.
And they'll actually, you know, retain all their nutrients, you know, through the winter so that they can make as many leaves as possible to photosynthesize as much as possible, but still only grow about a centimeter per year. And then what else is unique is that it's able to store those nutrients, and most plants do that in their root systems.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't even have roots. They have what are called rhizoids. They're just tiny little rootlets that hold them down on the bed of the lake.
And where do they fit in the ecosystem? Is this a plant that is sort of like food or camouflage for any animals in this system?
Well, in the tundra, this is actually where a lot of migratory birds go to.
Okay.
For their nesting season. And a lot of those birds will feed on those mosses.
Okay. That makes sense. I see. And then they're probably also feeding on the fruits of the berries and shrubbery that is up there as well. I bet that those plants are also important for the birds. Am I right?
Well, yeah, some of the other nesting birds, but most of the ones that are, you know, most of the waterfowl are going to be the ones that are feeding on the mosses.
That's very cool. And permafrost, just so that our listeners know, what does that mean? Can you tell us, like, what does that mean from a, you know, biological point of view?
You want to take that one, Pete? Yeah, sure. So
that's another sixth grade word.
permafrost is, I believe by definition, it's a soil that has to be remain completely frozen for more than 2 years.
Oh.
It kind of falls in the classification for soils of a gelisol.
Okay.
And those areas are essentially, once you go anywhere from, I've seen permafrost anywhere from a few inches below the surface down to a couple of feet, where you'll hit that frozen layer. It's essentially just, if you were digging down, you'd dig down and it'd be like hitting a layer of concrete. Which is why a lot of places in Alaska, there, if they do have any type of plumbing involved up in northern areas, it would be actually be above ground, just because you wouldn't be able to bury it because it'd be frozen.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's kind of the primary soil type in that area, and majority of it, especially in that, well, all of it in the Zone 1 area, and all these plants have adapted to be able to, if they do have root systems, to kind of have lateral growth.
Mm.
There are other pockets of permafrost throughout Alaska, and those times oftentimes can be seen in these wet areas where Rusty had mentioned, where mm-hmm. the water can't drain out of the bottom because it's frozen. And it's interesting, you'll see black spruce forests that you know have permafrost below it, because it's what's known as a drunken forest. And the reason for that being is that with that lateral growth of their root systems going across the ice, it may only be a couple of feet down, but over time these trees have grown tall enough to, that's a lot of torque on those roots, and they'll tip left or right. And you can see this if you're walking through these areas, all the trees will be shifted slightly one way or another just under their own weight, because they don't have the deep tap roots going down through that permafrost.
Wow, that's so fascinating. I'm going to have to look up that drunken forest. So we talked a lot about how plants, native plants, have adapted to the environment. I want to pivot now to talk about farming in Alaska. It's not a region that I necessarily associate with agriculture, but I know that you are both involved in that aspect in Alaska. What are farmers growing up there, and how are they doing it?
Well, one of our largest crops here is hay.
Mm-hmm.
And there was about Last year, approximately 22,000 acres were grown for hay.
Hmm.
But there's approximately, last year, 760 farms throughout Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And a total of 830,000 acres being farmed.
Wow, that is a lot.
It ranges from hogs, cattle, you know, for your livestock. There are some
that have been
production.
Selected. They're more adapted for our climates, and we can see that. That's evident just in simple things of some of the grains that we're growing. We've seen an increase in the amount of wheat and barley that's been growing over time, and in years past, say decade or so or better ago, it would have been odd to be able to collect a wheat harvest more than one out of every 4 years. But in the last few years, we've seen the adaptations and other different varieties that have enabled us to get continual wheat harvest year after year. And so with having these grains, it's been kind of a wonderful addition to our agricultural community. We also see, obviously, we're growing lots of oats and barley, which has also been able to increase our agricultural stores here in Alaska. And with the, especially with the increased demand for things like such as distilleries and whatnot that have been kind of new moving over the United States in the past few years, we're able to get in on that market also.
I think
that's
it's great.
Really exciting for a lot of growers.
I also was reading, and correct me if I'm wrong, that people are wanting more local food. Is that true? You know,
absolutely.
Vegetables. I mean, it's so expensive to ship produce from the continental United States, right? And it, when it arrives, it's not so awesome and fresh.
Well, one of the things with Alaska is how large it is.
Yeah.
So, say in the Anchorage area, most of your produce arrives here fairly fresh.
Okay.
But it's about 95 to some even say 98% of our food is brought in.
Right.
And when you get out to those remote areas where that, it will take an additional 2 weeks to get the produce there.
Wow.
So by the time it hits the shelf, it has tripled or quadrupled in price,
big.
But also is 3 times older. And so it's usually you're buying produce that has already started to deteriorate.
Yeah.
And paying a higher price for.
Yeah, I was looking at prices when I was researching Barrow, or it has a new name now, which I'm sure I can't pronounce, Unkjavik, I think. I was looking at the prices of things in the grocery store there. I was shocked. I mean, it was so expensive, you know, for things like Gatorade or anything that's heavy, you know.
Right, life in the village is expensive, that is for sure.
Yeah. So I'm really excited to hear that there is more agriculture happening in Alaska, and I'm guessing that if the weather gets warmer, which I guess in some areas it's trending in that direction, you'll be able to do more of that and be sort of more local in your food production.
We're hoping so. I mean, there's even a new push now to where has for the last several years, but the NRCS had a program for high tunnels.
Oh, yeah.
And Alaska has seen an exponential growth in high tunnels, especially in the Kenai Peninsula. And basically, it's a season extension to where you're able to grow some things that you wouldn't be able to outside, but it also gives you more growing days to where in South Central you might average about 90 days for growing.
Yeah, so maybe you might be able to get peppers going.
Correct.
Yeah,
yes.
Things
and
that take a little bit longer.
There are some greenhouses who are doing tomatoes, bell peppers, cucumbers, to where that is even becoming something. But one of the newest trends is there's a company now that's taking recycled refrigerator containers and shipping containers.
Yeah.
And they're retrofitting them into a hydroponic system. Able to transport them to remote villages to where they can operate year-round and grow fresh greens, some other produce, herbs.
Oh, that's so fantastic because a lot of your stuff does come in on ships, right? It's not all flown in. I'm sitting in a shipping container right now, this radio station.
I've read that.
And there's a garden on the roof. So we're not so far away after all. So I kind of want to end, our time has flown by. I kind of want to end with just a last question because of my sort of obsession with the Discovery Channel. I think of Alaska as like kind of the last wild frontier. What do you, and either of you guys or both can jump in here. What do you think are some of the challenges facing Alaska in the near future with regard to its habitats and environment? And how can people, what can people do to help with that, if anything?
Pete, I think you should touch on the whole warming.
All right, aspect. Yeah. Well, I was kind of thinking about, so just hearing that question, one of the other things that I deal with is managing invasive plants.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in an area that is so pristine and has the separation from a lot of our wild places and the road system,
mm-hmm.
is maintaining these just wonderful, whether they're rare or common plants in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And just emphasizing the beauty that's in like native plants and making sure that a lot of the ornamentals that we see, just to take care when people are planting these, that they don't have any escape that wind up getting into our native areas,
mm-hmm.
maintaining that, again, that pristine native beauty that's in Alaska, because it's gorgeous, and these plants are all around, and there is the ability to get seed for these native plants, which is some of what we do here at the Plant Material Center, and to actually get the plants themselves. So that's kind of what was being my plug for trying to help these ecosystems maintain their pristine native abilities.
Rusty, do you want to add to any of that?
No, I think he pretty much touched it, you know, to where, of course, it's a great thing that if it does get warmer, that we're able to have longer seasons and
right.
grow different things. But
right.
then we also are potentially going to introduce things that would affect our natural ecosystem.
Yeah. It's on my bucket list, guys. I want to come up there someday, probably in the summer. Thank you both so much for being on the show. Do you all want to share your website where people can learn more about the work that you're doing?
Sure. It's www.plants.alaska.gov.
Thank you both so much for being on the show. Stay warm.
Thank you. You too.
All right, thank you very much.
Okay. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to go to a much warmer environment, to Puerto Rico. Stay tuned to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Hi, welcome back to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Today on the second half of the show, we're revisiting Zone 13 in Puerto Rico for an update on the forests and landscapes there post-hurricanes. Our guest for this part of the show is Dr. Grisel Gonzalez, soil scientist and lead researcher at the International Institute of Tropical Forestry, which is part of the U.S. Forest Service. Dr. Gonzalez has a doctorate of philosophy in soil ecology and biology from the University of Colorado in Boulder and has authored over 100 scientific publications. She survived Hurricane Maria while sheltered at home in the town of Luquillo in northeast Puerto Rico with her husband and 9-year-old son. Dr. Gonzalez, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
So, This is a question that I like to ask our guests sometimes. What brought you to a career in science and soil ecology in particular?
Well, it was not that clear from the beginning. Originally, I was looking into doing a bachelor's degree in biology just as a way to get into the medical school.
Hmm.
But I took an ecology class, and I was fascinated by learning of the different ecosystems. And then I decided to have a research experience as a way to beef up my resume before applying to med schools.
Mm-hmm.
So I volunteered to work in a plant physiology lab at the University of Puerto Rico while doing my bachelor's degree. And as I was going out in the field visiting the different forests like the mangroves and freshwater swamps and all of that, I had the opportunity to visit a field station in the El Yunque National Forest. And they were looking for assistance for a project to look for earthworms in the forest.
Wow.
And I thought, well, that's different.
Yes.
Okay, I'll give it a try, do that for a day, and if I can handle the worms, I think I can take the job. And so I did, and I fell in love with the earthworms and decided to look into the possibility of doing a master's degree on soil ecology and soil biology in particular. And that's how my career evolved.
That's so interesting. And I love stories like that. Alice and I love to share because people's paths are not always direct. There's a lot of zigging and zagging a lot. And, you know, connections with nature sometimes really change people's directions in life.
Yes.
So it's fascinating. So tell us a little bit briefly about the work that's being done at the Institute and the research there and how it impacts the community. Dr. Gonzalez, can you hear us? I wonder if we lost the line. It's pretty, can you hear us? No. The lines in Puerto Rico sometimes drop suddenly. In fact, when I was talking to my friend Scott, I have sometimes in the middle of a conversation, it'll drop because the electric grid is not 100% there yet. And sometimes they only have power for like 3 or 4 hours a day. In fact, he was telling me that he just got potable water in his area of Vieques, and he was really super excited about that. It's still pretty rough out there. Most of his island doesn't have power. He lives on a small island off the coast of Puerto Rico. So, you know, at any moment it can go out. He was saying that diesel fuel, gas, those are really still very much in short supply. The ferries aren't entirely running. I think we have Dr. Gonzalez back. Dr. Gonzalez?
Yes.
Hi. Okay. So tell us briefly a little bit about the work that's being done at the Institute and the research there and how it impacts the community at large.
Yes, the International Institute of Tropical Forestry is the one research unit within the Forest Service that is tasked to develop science that contributes to the conservation of forests, wildlife, and watersheds of the American tropics. And we do this in the context of environmental change.
Okay.
So we hope that our accomplishments provide products and services that can anticipate the needs of society as it mitigates and adapts to environmental change.
Yeah.
And these events as related to the hurricanes are very much what we're tasked to do.
Exactly. Let's talk about the hurricanes now. Two hurricanes hit Puerto Rico and the Caribbean in September, Irma and Maria. Dr. Gonzalez, you were there. I would love for you to share, if you can, your account of what it was like to witness that and what it looked like on the ground after the hurricane passed.
Yes, I was here. I was in Puerto Rico during Hurricane Hugo in 1989 and again during Hurricane Maria this September.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an intense experience. From my perspective, Hurricane Maria was much stronger mm-hmm. than Hugo was in 89. For both of these events, I weathered the storm in cement houses, but during Maria, I was in the northeastern part of the island in Luquillo,
mm-hmm.
and the house was shaking.
Wow.
And the sustained winds were so strong that were nonstop. So there was a lot of whistling. It sounded like a train was just coming, and, wow. and never ending.
Wow.
It was intense. And after the event ended, next day when people are getting out to their backyards, it was a surreal scene because everything, all the trees were defoliated. Basically, it was a dry landscape. Everything was brown, where it was green and colors and flowers overnight. What we could see was different shades of browns and kind of gray. The first few days after the hurricanes, there was kind of like a fog in the air. So it seemed like a landscape from a temperate zone where we were at the end of the fall getting into the winter.
Yes.
So it was very strange. We were used to the lush green vegetation, and overnight we had this changed landscape.
Yes, my friend Scott described it that way as well. On Vieques, he said, there's not a leaf on any of the trees. Not a one. And we talked about that in our chat, defoliation versus deforestation. We're now about 3 months past the hurricane. Can you tell us a little bit about what kind of recovery you're seeing in the flora of Puerto Rico?
Sure. So right after the event, this was a major defoliation event where most of the trees lost their leaves. Now, 2-3 months after, we start seeing there is a lot of greening up, leafing off of the trees, particularly at the low elevations in the mountains. You could see a lot of recovery. Those trees that are standing, that had branches fall, but the main stem still standing, you see a lot of sprouting and leafing up. So there is a very fast recovery in the lowlands. In some of the higher elevation forests, for example, at the top of El Yunque National Forest, mm-hmm. about 1,000 meters in elevation, there is some recovery in terms of leafing up, but not as fast as it's now evident in the lower elevations.
Okay.
Yes, there is a difference between defoliation and deforestation, and I think it's important that we make this distinction.
Yes.
With a hurricane, we saw this defoliation, but deforestation is when we extract the trees, this material, and use it for other purposes. In this case, for the areas that are under forest protection, for example,
mm-hmm.
we are not extracting that material, so we are not going through a deforestation process, but the trees were defoliated, lost their leaves, and
there
will
be a
natural process there of recovery taking place.
I know, and that's what's really interesting that I found. When we chatted, you mentioned that, you know, you're going to, in the process of sort of cleaning up, you're going to clear the roads and everything. But in the forest itself, in the natural areas, you're going to leave the down trees and the other vegetation in place. And that's going to kind of feed the new species that are going to take advantage of this kind of more open canopy. Can you talk a little bit about that sort of natural selection that's happening now and how it's going to affect the composition of the forest in the future?
Sure. In these forests, there are already plant species that have developed adaptations to live under these hurricane conditions. They grow shorter. They also, for example, develop other strategies like root drafting. They tighten their roots, particularly along the ridge slopes. And that's a way for them to sustain the winds, but also to transfer nutrients from one to the other. So the forest itself already has some mechanisms for withstanding these conditions. But once there is a strong event and the branches fall, some trees might get uprooted, and you leave them in place, there is a process of recovery that takes place just naturally. Many of these leaves act like fertilizers to the system, because usually when they senesce and they fall, they go through the process of retranslocation, where a lot of the nutrients go from the leaves into the tree trunk, sometimes even to the root as a reservoir, and then they use again for production. But once we have a hurricane event, these leaves get to the ground immediately. They have not gone through this process of retranslocation. So when they go into the ground, they have a lot of nutrients like nitrogen, phosphorus, that are very limiting in these tropical soils that have such high clay content. So when you leave the leaves, also the woody material through time as it decomposes, they just act like a fertilizer to the system. And as the material decays, it triggers a cascade of events where it changes the microbes that grow in the sites, even the little microarthropods, that the little animals that live, that eat from the fungi or the bacteria. And this accelerates the decomposition rate and the nutrient release in the system. And then plants that take advantage of these high temperature, high light environment, and the nutrients that are also available in the system now, they use it and take advantage, and then they take off and they start producing shade and dominating the canopy of the forest. So you see a shift in the composition from mature species that are more common under shady conditions to another composition where we see these light-demanding pioneer species are called taking over. But there are other mature species in the forest that that have a lot of seeds. There is a seed bank that it's kind of the potential of the forest. And when there is a gap, light's reaching the soils, these seeds are there just waiting for the right moment to germinate. So we have some native species that is their strategy, their life history strategy to grow. It's waiting for these events when they take over.
So potentially the next time I come to visit Puerto Rico and El Junque, I might see a different kind of forest.
You might see...
I mean, I probably won't notice it, but, you know, if I went with a naturalist, I bet there might be some things that I might not have seen if I'd come when I'd come 5 years ago.
Yes. Well, you might see the same species, but the proportion, the frequency that you can find them in the landscape might change from site to site.
Right. That makes sense. Well, I do intend to come back. I want to talk about the people a bit, and the urban forest. You said something to me that really stuck with me when we had our conversation. You said that the greening of the trees and plants had a social component and not just an ecological one. Can you tell our listeners what you meant by that?
Yes. Well, right after the hurricane, people were devastated just by finding the damages that houses, business, the infrastructure had gone through.
Yeah.
But then next to it was the forest, the urban landscapes, the yards, people yards and gardens, how they were also affected.
Yes.
So immediately, you know, that was a part of the of the socio-ecological environment that everybody was going through that was not very positive in the day or two after the hurricane. But 4 or 5 days into after the hurricane that we started seeing the green up, the leafing up, people started connecting with nature and making these parallel comparisons how nature was able to withstand this event and now was finding a way to recover, and how vegetation was also kind of showing signs of resistance and resilience and adaptation. And a lot of people were saying, well, nature is showing us the way. If they can adapt, if they can now show recovery, we can too. And then has some native species or some species in the landscape, they did better than others. People also make those comparisons on the socio-ecological level.
Yes.
In terms of urban forests and urban ecology, there's also a strong link between humans and the trees. And this is a component that have been described in other events, like in New Orleans after Katrina, mm-hmm. how people could relate to particular trees as spots in the landscape, how they found their houses, how they relate to the history of the places. Very similar we're experiencing here in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria.
And I can relate to that on a personal level. You know, I've lived through 9/11 here in New York City, and there is a tree, I believe it's an oak, that survived in the rubble of 9/11. Mm-hmm. And it was replanted. And people, I think, at a similar level, were able to relate to that. They're like, wow, if that tree can make it survive the horror of that site, we can too, you know?
Yes, and amazing enough, there's even some fruit trees that are fruiting.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, so people very much relate to that aspect of recovery in the landscape.
Well, I can talk to you for hours. I think that your hopefulness is really important, and I think the message is people can learn from the trees. And I know there's a lot of work to be done in Puerto Rico still, but it's really, really great to get your hopeful message, Dr. Gonzalez. Thank you so much for being on the show, and I'm going to share a link to the Institute on our social media so that people can follow your work. There's so many great photos and information about what you're doing. Thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay. So you've been listening to the last show of 2017 of We Dig Plants. It was written and produced by Carmen DeVito and Alice Krieg. Please remember to subscribe to our blog, WeDigPlantsPodcast.com, or if you're a Twitterer, you can follow us at WeDigPlants to stay current on our projects and upcoming shows, or follow us on Instagram at WeDigPlants/GroundworksGardensNYC. Thanks for listening. See you in the virtual garden.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.